You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here to discuss our May 2026 book club pick, No No Boy by John Okada. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you gain access to our members-only Discord server, where you can chat with us and fellow book club members in real time about all sorts of topics, including our monthly book club picks. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a month, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly book club pick. And our next selection process will begin by the time you listen to this episode. So if you'd like to have a say in what book we are reading in July to kick off the summer season, join now at patreon.com/booksandboba. Rira, we are at the end of Heritage Month. How was your APAM this year?
I don't think I did anything like every day is Asian Heritage Day for me. So I guess like I went to the Ren Fair, I went to Stars on Ice. I did things that were not related to I guess there's Alyssa Liu. So I was like, yeah, I mean, Alyssa Liu and Ellie Kam. And I'm like, OK, I'm celebrating Asian American Olympians. But
that counts. I mean, you're celebrating Asian American excellence and I'm sure they are very excellent. How was the experience?
It was really good. We didn't really know what to expect because I've never been to an ice show before, but it was at the Anaheim Honda Center where, you know, they play hockey all the time. So they skated over a hockey ice rink and it was like really interesting because they had different programs. Some of them performed their gala skates. So Alyssa Liu and Amber Glenn, they also performed their gala skate. And there were some like joint performances, so that was pretty cool. I mean, in terms of like Asian American events, I know that my local bookstore is having a panel with a bunch of Asian American local authors, and I think CB is actually going to be there. So CB Lee, the author of Not Your Sidekick and Clash of Steel, I think she's going to be there. I think somebody else that we may have interviewed is going to be there, so I might pop in. Yeah, there's like a couple events at the very end of the month, so maybe.
Yeah, I mean, at the point that we're recording this episode, there's only like 2 days left in the month of May. So I honestly didn't do anything out in public this year. I was going to go to Smorgasburg to check out their AAPI market because every year they have like a day where they bring a lot of the Asian American vendors to showcase their wares and foods. And I always look forward to it because it's always really cool. Some of my friends are out there. It's always really cool to check out what's out there. But both of my kids got sick. And so that's all I've been dealing with the last like 2 weeks at this point is getting the kids better and then myself getting better because I did catch what my kids had. So if you listen to our interview with Vincent Yu that dropped last week, you can hear my voice is noticeably more hoarse than usual.
I mean, it happens. I mean, I remember like it was a different author interview a couple of years ago. Like we scheduled that interview a day after a BTS concert and my voice was just completely gone. So I was like in a much like lower energy with my voice being very monotone. So it happens.
Yeah.
We're not robots. Thankfully, we're not AI.
Yeah. But, you know, next year, my kids will be two and a half during APAM. So maybe that'll give me the opportunity to go out and attend more events. But yeah, hopefully you all had a great Heritage Month. You know, if you're on Discord, let us know what you did. And if possible, show some pictures. I would love to see what you saw or ate. But yeah, with that, let's get into our book club discussion of No No Boy by John Okada. As always, in our book club discussion episodes, we do discuss our book club pick in its entirety, including all plot and character related spoilers. So if you have not read No No Boy yet and do care about being spoiled, This is your cue to hit pause and finish the book and then come back and listen to our discussion. But if you've already finished No No Boy, or if you don't care about being spoiled, we can get started. Rira can kick us off as always with the book jacket description of No No Boy.
All right. No No Boy tells the story of Ichiro Yamada, a fictional version of the real-life No No Boys. Yamada answered no twice in a compulsory government questionnaire as to whether he would serve in the armed forces and swear loyalty to the United States. Unwilling to pledge himself to the country that interned him and his family, Ichiro earns 2 years in prison and the hostility of his family and community when he returns home to Seattle.
Yeah, so this book was first published in 1957. And I think on record, it's one of the, we can't say for certain, but definitely one of the first novels published by an Asian American. I did look up what other novels were published in 1957 to check out what its contemporaries were. So other novels published in 1957, On the Road by Jack Kerouac, Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, and The Cat in the Hat by Dr. Seuss. So definitely a time when great novels are being released. Arguable, if you count Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged as a great novel, it definitely has different conversations, but it has or probably worse, affected the world we live in today. But interesting enough, there was another Asian American novel published in 1957, the original Flower Drum Song, the novel, a year before it became a Hammerstein musical, was also published in 1957. And it's interesting because these two books are very much diametrically opposed in the spectrum of Asian American fiction, right? Flower Drum Song is all about assimilation, how you need to give up your ties to the old world in order to live in America. Whereas No No Boy definitely is about it's really hard to divest yourself of all that, the Asian and Asian American experience.
Yeah. I did not know that the Flower Drum Song came out in the same year. That is wild. So last night, I went on YouTube and I was like, let me see if there's any documentaries on No No Boy. And there was one. It was called In Search of No No Boy. And I think it was co-produced with PBS, but I found it on the Seattle channel and it's free, you guys. And it was produced by Frank Abe. And it goes into the history of its publication and just the inspiration for No No Boy, because No No Boy, the protagonist Ichiro, is inspired by a specific draft resistor. His name was Jim Akutsu. And John Okada, the author, would just kind of follow him around and kind of chat with him and kind of get feelers for what he went through and how the community reacted to him. Jim Akutsu has said on record multiple times that he does not agree with the portrayal of his pretty much himself in this book. But I'm sure there were draft resistors who, probably had similar thoughts as Ichiro, which, this is a novel. And John Okada famously said, only in fiction can the hopes and fears and joys and sorrows of people be adequately recorded. So even though this book is based on history and it is very contemporary because it originally came out in 1957, like Marvin said, and the end of World War II was only 12
years?
Yeah, 12 years ago. So it's very fresh. Okay. So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I first read this book almost 20 years ago, actually, for an Asian American literature class. And reading it again, it really struck me how raw this book was, both in terms of technical writing, but also in terms of just emotions. Like John Okada writes with this need for you to know what it was like, know what people were thinking. It's not a very subtle book, right? The subtext is pretty much in the text at all times with the omniscient narrator. But I think given the context of when this book was written and when it was published, I think it makes sense because at the time, this was literally the only book. John was writing the book that he wanted to see that he had no model for, right? His book would go on to inspire a new generation of Asian American, Japanese American writers. But when he was writing it, it was he needed the readers to know what it was like to be Japanese American post-war, whether you were a draft resistor or not.
Yeah, I think he knew how America would try to bury this history, like bury, like, you know, this dastardly deed of putting their citizens in concentration camps just because of, you know, how their faces looked. So he's just like, I'm not going to let them forget what they did to us, because this book was published 12 years after the end of World War II. And at that point, Japanese Americans were trying to reintegrate back into the towns and communities that they were, you know, pretty much an integral part of. They, you know, ran hotels, restaurants, dry cleaners. A lot of them were scholars. And it was just like immigrating back into the country again. And it's a horribly, horribly traumatic experience. And around this time, around like the 12-year mark, this was when Japanese Americans were finally being seen as like the quote unquote model minority. They were like, there were like articles saying like, wow, like look at how Japanese Americans have rebuilt themselves after the war. They're like, look at their excellence and their resilience. And it's just like, okay, obviously releasing this book during a time when post-war scars were very much fresh, and the community was just like, we need to have our like best face forward. Not the ideal environment for this book to come out in.
And I think John also knew kind of how his community was going to be like, right? There's this Japanese saying, "Dakaganai," which means it can't be helped, right? It's a motif in another book by a Japanese American called Pharaoh the Imaginar about life. It's a memoir about life in the camps. But this prevailing kind of, I guess, very culturally Japanese mindset, which is like, you can't help what you can't help. Like, you just have to, like, move on, accept it and move on. That, like, I think also prevailed in terms of, like, post-war life, like, post-camp life, right? Because there's also other books and other films, other documentaries covering this part of the Japanese-American this part of Japanese-American narrative films as well. But, like, you know, before leaving, a lot of the Japanese Americans had to sell their land, sell their businesses. And so, you know, coming back, like, it's not like people held the business for them. Some people did. Like, some people were good. And that's a theme that recurs in this book as well. But a lot of people bought their business, bought their land for pennies on the dollar. And when the original owners came back, ended up being employees of their former businesses, or, you know, sharecroppers, or just, like, not allowed back at all, right? So it's, like, it's still not a very, like, fair situation. But, like, I think there's this notion that people just wanted to move on. And we could talk more about the themes, because it is a major theme in this book. The idea of, like, how do you, like, who's moving on, who's not moving on, and what does that do to people? But I'm sure most of you have the University of Washington printing of this book. And if you do have that version, it takes like a good like 50 pages, right, before you actually get to the first chapter of No No Boy, because there is a long foreword that was from the original printing, but also an additional foreword by Ruth Ozeki, right? Talking about like a more...
Yeah, so that's the 2014 version. And it has the foreword by Ruth Ozeki. And it's a beautiful foreword. I really loved how like sincere it was. Like she writes it as if it's like a letter to John Okada. And, you know, it's like it's like writing across time. So it's like really cool. And it also has the original introduction when it came out in the second printing back in the 1970s by Lawson Fusao Inada. So he was one of the Asian American writers who rediscovered this book. And I was wondering when we picked up this book, I was like, okay, how are we going to talk about it? Like, you can't remove like the story out of its publishing history. It's very much integrated. You have to look at it through that lens, right? So I would say like its history with publishing is very much an Asian American experience. That
The book came out, I think the initial printing was what, 1500 copies, or was it 500? It was very low, right?
It was 1500, and it was originally published by a Japanese publisher.
Yeah.
And because, like, can you imagine, you're an American novelist and you have to sell your book to a Japanese publisher of like English works? So in that case, like, people got copies of No No Boy in Japan before it even got distributed in America.
Yeah. And even in America, it didn't do well, right? It didn't sell out its initial run of 1,500 books up through the 70s, right? And
yeah.
And it's because it's a story we hear a lot also from people who write about, like, even contemporary authors now writing about the war, whether it be the Vietnam War, World War II, the myriad civil wars that the Asian American communities come from. And it's like, people don't want to, like, why are you airing our dirty laundry? Why are you talking about these things? Like, let's just move on. We've moved on. We don't need to talk about the trauma, right? And it wasn't until in the 70s where it was picked up on at a used bookstore by a group of scholars and writers and poets who were surprised that there was this fully formed novel about the Asian American experience written 20 years ago that, like, no one's heard about.
Yeah, so the book was rediscovered by Asian American writers Frank Chin, Lawson Fusao Inada, like I mentioned earlier, and Sean Wong. And when you hear about, like, their story of, you know, trying to learn more about John Okada and this book, it's heartbreaking because John Okada had passed away, like, months before they discovered this book. And he died of a heart attack in his late 40s. And he never finished his second novel, which the manuscript got burnt. So we don't have traces of it now. But they, at the time, were trying to have this project where they were finding, like, early Asian American writers and trying to make an anthology of it. And this is how they, like, kind of stumbled across John Okada's book. And what had happened was they're like, okay, we need people to read this book. And, you know, there was such a low run of copies. They can't really track all the original copies that got sold. So they decided to make their own copies. They contacted University of Washington Press, and John Okada is an alum of University of Washington. And originally the school was just like, yeah, we're not printing this. Like, why should we print this? And then they were like, actually, give us $5,000 and we will, you know, we will do, like, an original print. So they're like, okay, I guess we'll do that. So they sold out of the first two printings. And that kind of became the start of, I don't know, like, this resurgence of John Okada and also, like, you know, classic Asian American literature becoming a thing in the scholarly communities.
I mean, I feel like it hit, basically, the book came out before its time, right? Because in the 1950s, like we mentioned, people weren't looking to, like, reflect on the Asian American experience. They wanted to put their heads down and assimilate and, like, try to live in the world. The late 60s, early 70s, this was the era of the civil rights movement. I think the 70s was also, like, when the redress movement started with the Japanese American community, where, like, the Sansei, the children of the Nisei, having finally learned about the full, like, horrors of camp, went out and tried to, like, literally get the government to, like, apologize to their parents, which they eventually succeeded in. Like, the government did eventually issue a formal apology, and, like, I think they gave everyone who was still alive, like, $1,000 or something.
Yeah, still not enough for, you know, the trauma that they inflicted. But also, this was, like, around the tail end of the Vietnam War, if I'm correct. And of course, you know, there were feelings about being drafted into the Vietnam War and how, like, young people were, like, resisting on college campuses everywhere across America. So this book about a draft resistor, like, I think its reemergence in society, like, it hit at the right time. I can only imagine as a student in, like, 1975, picking up this book for the first time and never seeing Asian Americans represented in literature before. And you're just like, wow, it's raw. It feels like I'm reading a contemporary when in actuality, the book came out like 20 years before.
To be fair, reading it in 2026, it still feels like reading a contemporary story. Right? I don't think I feel like the country we live in, you know, a lot of the things that this book covers is still very much relevant. A lot of Asian American themes this book covers is still very much relevant. I really felt it when Frank Chin in his afterword talked about like how here was a book written in the 1950s talking about how difficult it was to be both Asian and American, and how difficult it is to reconcile being both Asian and American and Asian American identity, and how like it's asking the same questions we're asking today in the 1970s. And like Frank, we're still asking the same questions in 2026. We're still trying to figure that out too.
Yeah. And like, I really love Ruth Ozeki's foreword because, you know, she mentions like, this is the first time I've seen an angry Japanese American. Cause, you know, in like other future literature and like tropes, you know, it's like, oh, the Japanese are very much like, it is what it is. They're very solemn. And I guess like we have this image of them being pacifists, but actually like they carry a lot of anger. And it's like, yeah. So I can only imagine just like how powerful it was for, you know, Japanese Americans who, you know, whose parents have like gone through being like born and living through the traumas of concentration camps. And it's like, yeah, I am angry and it's okay to be angry because what they did to us was fucked up.
Yeah, I think the civil rights era was like the defining emotion was anger. It was anger that couldn't be repressed any longer and like being put to practical positive use, right? And even back in 2004 when I first read this book, I was getting angry because like, it was the first time I had learned about the draft resistors, like the no-no boys, right? The loyalty questionnaire that they asked, because in the history books that we grew up with, at least here in California, we learned about Japanese internment. We read Farewell to Manzanar. We learned about the 442nd. We learned about how they were the most decorated unit in the army during the war. And that's kind of what the mainstream, like his history wants to focus on. And so learning that there were people who like said no to serving in the army and asked questions about like, why would I want to fight for you when you have deemed me not one of you, right? Officially. And I think it was really like, it's kind of sad that for a lot of us, we have to learn our history through fiction like this. And it's not even fiction that it's not required reading, right? No-No Boy is assigned in like a lot of Asian American Literature 101 classes. But not everyone takes those classes.
Yeah, like I didn't take those classes. And this was my first time reading No-No Boy. even though I like, you know, learned about it. And I was just like, okay, well, I think for me, it was just kind of like, all right, well, I'm a little bit nervous about talking about this book because obviously there's a lot of scholarship on it. There are people with PhDs who have done dissertations on No-No Boy, which you could probably look up on Google somewhere. And I was just like, what can we bring to this conversation as Asian Americans who now live in 2026 and have like way more privileges? But like Marvin said, like we are asking the same questions of like, what does it mean to be American but not considered American, and to have the face of an alien, and to have ties to our motherland culture, and how that can feel like a betrayal to the culture that we were raised in America. And I was just like, okay, like it is a very contemporary issue, which is, you know, very surprising in the year 2026. And I think people need to like understand that John Okada was not a no-no boy. He was not a draft resistor. He was actually a volunteer. He rode on like those giant B-24 planes that would fly across Japan. And he and a bunch of other Japanese American volunteers, they would interpret in real time what they were hearing from the Japanese over through the airwaves. And the introduction to this book, the prologue for this book, is a Japanese American soldier who is, you know, translating and interpreting. And the white officer who is like sitting next to him is just like, hey, so where are you from? And he's like, Wyoming. And they're like, oh, so your family is, you know, they're farmers, right? And he's like, no, not exactly. And he pretty much tells him about, you know, the camp and how he didn't really have a choice to sign up for the army, because it was just like either go to prison or go to the army. Like, it's like, is that really a choice? And that's how we begin. And it kind of fades out. And then chapter one, we get into Ichiro's return to Seattle.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know if we need to go plot point by plot point, but Ichiro comes back and he immediately runs into like an old acquaintance who did serve, right? And we get to see kind of the central conflict, internal conflict with Ichiro, which is like he knows what he did was wrong in the eyes of law. It feels wrong for him, to him as an American as well. And so he like can't reconcile that with himself. Like, how can he live free with this burden on him? And especially when the first person he meets was someone who served. And even before the interaction starts, you can see like the tension. Like, Ichiro just does not want anything to do with this guy because he knows like there's nothing he can say. Like, when you're coming from a position of, I already know I did wrong, like it's hard to like move forward from that, right? And like the guy he meets, Ito, complete dick, right? He is just not a good dude. He is like, immediately once he realizes that Ichiro was a no-no boy, like kind of confirms his suspicions that like he is not welcome. Like, he is not like one of them anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, Ichiro is branded as a traitor in the eyes of his community, like right off the bat. And I was like, what a way to start a novel.
Yeah. Well, his peers, not his community, right? Because certain members of the community see him as a hero, right? And that's just really interesting. I think, you know, we meet his, he goes home to Seattle, he meets his parents, and we meet his mom and dad who are like, and I think this is where like, no, this book is literary fiction. And so, you know, you want to read it in terms of like the characters are not just characters. They're also metaphor, they're allegory, they're representing something, right? And Ichiro's parents are definitely representing like two sides of the Japanese American immigrant experience, right? Like, are you American?
Yeah, the
are you Japanese?
Experience.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And we find that his mom, she's so proud of him, right? Because he went to jail for refusing to serve in the army. But it is also has also deluded herself into thinking that Japan has won the war, because there's no way Japan could have lost the war. And that causes even more tension, because like for Ichiro, his internal thing is like, I went to jail for a lot of reasons, right? But one of them was because of you, because you taught me that I'm Japanese. And I think the mom's a really interesting character, because I think she's polarizing. Right? I read some reviews that like a lot of people didn't really understand the mom character. Like, they... like, why is she so crazy? Why is she so like off the wall? But it's like, I think it's because she represents like the Japanese side of his identity that's like still considers themselves not American, not fully American, because they have a place they belong to overseas.
You know, it's really funny when I met the mother in the book, I immediately thought, wow, this is like some Scientology MAGA cult mindset. Because that's what people who like are in cults, you know, like their reality is just not the same as ours. Like, it's and like Japan, like Japanese people were fed so much propaganda. And of course, like, she still kept ties with, you know, what was happening in Japan. So like one of the instances that she kind of proves her delusion is she pulls out this like flyer that was like being passed around in like South America. And it was saying like, oh yeah, Japan, you know, hasn't lost the war. They're bringing ships for people who stayed loyal in America so they can take them back to Japan. And I'm like, okay, that is just like a level of delusion, fake news believing that I can see in modern day life. So it wasn't that like disbelieving to me as a reader.
Yeah. But she also represents, again, those first generation immigrants who like did not intend to stay. Like, America is not their end game. America is a stepping stone to what they really want, which is a better life back home. And we see that also in today times, right? A lot of immigrants, if you didn't come because of, you know, you're a refugee, if you came because of education, because of jobs, a lot of immigrant parents that I know also have this mindset. It's like, oh, we're not American, we're Chinese. We're not American, we're Korean. We're not American, we're, you know, so-and-so. Because to them, this is not their real country. Like, this is where they're living right now, right? And especially, like, you know, if you think about from their point of view, America also made it pretty clear that you are not American because they jailed you for four years and took away your rights.
Also, they didn't give you a naturalization process back then. Back then, if you were an immigrant, you stayed an immigrant. The only reason why, like, Nisei were able to get citizenships was because they were born in America, birthright citizenship, which is, you know, currently under attack.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I like definitely related to, you know, like Marvin mentioned that, like, it is a mindset that a lot of immigrant parents have of, like, this is a temporary home. This is not my real country. I'm going to, you know, make a lot of money and go back to my home country and we're going to have an easier life. And this is something that my parents went through as well. We didn't come here because we were refugees. We came literally because of my dad's job. It was supposed to be temporary and it just kept getting extended and extended. And by the point where like his company said, hey, we need you to move back to Korea, your job is done. I was in high school and I still had my Korean citizenship at that time. So it wasn't like I can just come back to America like easily, I guess. So it was just like, okay, this is something that people go through now with their immigrant parents. And you're trying to explain to them, like, it's not like I can pick up my life and just go to Korea or Japan and fit in immediately. Because even if you did your best to, like, make sure that I retained my culture, you can't expect me to not love America in a way. Because it's like,
yeah,
like, there's this whole passage in the book where it was like, I am half Japanese and I am half American, but you are making me hate the half that you even, you know, that you, like, fostered me in. It's a betrayal either way. So I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've read a ton of diaspora literature for this podcast, for this book club. And so, you know, the idea of, like, yeah. So, like, we're very familiar with the idea of, like, once someone leaves the country, like, they've become something entirely different. And no matter what you do, there's no going back. Especially if you have kids, especially if they grew up in another culture, another set of values. And, you know, you contrast Ichiro's mom with Ichiro's dad, who is, like, obviously going through something. Like, he has a drinking problem, he's coping, he's self-medicating. And it's not until he's, like, relieved of his burden that he can finally accept that this is where he is now. He lives in America, this is where he's going to move on.
Yeah, everybody is traumatized by the same thing. It's just, like, different reactions of the same trauma of, like, yeah, your country sent you to concentration camps and pretty much said, hey, like, your citizenship doesn't matter. So everybody's dealing with the grief and trauma in different ways. I was really baffled. We don't have to go plot by plot, but on Ichiro's first day back in Seattle, his mom is like, oh, let's go visit my friends and, like, you know, reintegrate you into society. And, like, her friends also believe that Japan did not lose the war. And I was like, okay, there's, like, a subgroup of people. But when they go to, like, the final family's home, he's, like, surprised because he was like, oh, like, they didn't have a house before because they were always planning to move back to Japan. So they actually planted roots. Okay, maybe, like, they're not as delusional as my mom. Okay. But then he finds out that that family, they lost their son in the war. Their son said yes to both of the questions on the survey, and he served, and he died by a stray bullet. And it was just like,
yeah.
And Ichiro's mom is just like, oh, you know, their son would still be alive today if he was loyal to Japan and just like said no on the survey like you. And I'm like, I don't think that's comforting.
It's such like narcissistic mom behavior, right? Like, or just like mean girl mom behavior. So I'm going to take you. It's like the bizarro version of showing off your kid who got into Harvard to other parents who didn't get into Harvard.
Oh yeah, I was getting right? that vibes too. It's like very much like, oh, let me show you how much better my kid is compared to yours.
Because he didn't die.
Right? But that kid died.
Like, yeah, it was pretty fucked up. And again, it's just like, it's just to show that like in the eyes of his mom, right? Him going to jail was a triumph. Him going to jail was him accepting that he is Japanese first. And that makes her the proudest. That makes her so proud. Right? She has to show that off to all her friends whose kid didn't do that. And now they're dead because he didn't do that. Definitely a fucked up scene, but definitely a very like, you know, it does a good job illustrating like kind of the divide, even in the Issei parents' like stories.
So we met Ito in like the inciting incident, the dick who was just like, you were a no-no boy, I'm going to piss on your suitcase the next time I see you. Contrasting that kind of behavior is Kenji Kano, who is the main character and who becomes Ichiro's like, you know, only friend.
Only real friend, time. Right? The only person only who's real looking friend. Out for him. Yeah, because like before Kenji, we get introduced to Freddy, who was like a fellow no-no boy, who's kind of just like, kind of like his dad, kind of just drifting through life, kind of self-medicating and like being essentially manic, right? He's just living off fumes. And, you know, again, it does not, the book does not trade in subtext. It literally tells you, yeah, like he's living like if he stops to think about it, he'll drown.
Yeah, he is living life day by day and not thinking about his future at all. And it's like Ichiro is just like, I don't want to live like that. Like I already feel horrible about what I did. I already have like so much guilt and shame, but I don't want to end up like that. So his friendship with Kenji is like extremely important for his development.
Yeah. Like, again, you know, reading the book through the lens of like metaphor and allegory and all that, like Freddy is essentially the path Ichiro could take if he does not come out of the spiral, right? That's like one path for no-no boys. And in meeting Kenji and getting like kind of a new perspective, he's able to, at the very least, change his mindset a little bit. And Kenji is, you know, set up as essentially his polar opposite, right? Kenji is a war veteran. He served in the army, but he came back injured. And he has basically his leg is rotting and the doctors keep cutting pieces from it, but it's not enough to stop the rot. And so he has kind of accepted that, like, he's going to die soon. And so John Okada poses this really interesting like relationship between, you know, Ichiro, who is a guy who has nothing to live for, but will live for a long time, presumably. And Kenji, who got the glory, did the right thing in their minds, but won't live for much longer.
Yeah, I mean, the cost of that glory is still, you know, almost the same as Ichiro. You know, it's just like, what kind of life did they sentence us to? And I thought it was really interesting that, like, you know, Ichiro tells Kenji, it was like, I wish I could trade my life with you. Cause even though you're missing a leg, you're able to hold your head up high. You're able to, you know, you're able to just go to sleep at night knowing that you made the right decision. And Kenji's like, did I make the right decision? Because I'm gonna die real soon and I have necrosis on this leg. Is this really the life that you want to live? And Ichiro's like, yeah, why not? And it's like, oh, Kenji's like, okay, we need to get you some help because this is a very unhealthy like mindset that you have.
Yeah, Kenji decides he's gonna spend his remaining days to save Ichiro's life. And that, you know, if that's a true bro right there. That's true.
Yeah, that's a true friend. Yeah.
We skip past this, but I think it was the end of the first chapter. We get the scene where the style of the story gets a little confusing and what thoughts are actually Ichiro's and what thoughts is just the omniscient narrator kind of saying, like the author's thoughts. But like we get the scene where they're talking, where they portray the courtroom where the draft resistors were brought in to be sentenced, and were asked like, why did you answer no to the loyalty questions? And they go through like all the various reasons why one would say no, right? I thought that was really interesting. It's one of those passages where like it's very didactic, right? It's definitely there to like explain to the readers who aren't familiar with what happened, like what were the reasons why someone would say no to being conscripted. But it's also very powerful in that like all the reasons that they give make sense to us reading it in like 2026, right? Like, yeah, it's like you don't want to fight someone who might be your brother or might be your family member. You don't want to fight the country that your parents come from. You don't want to fight for a country that like that has told you explicitly that you're not one of them. Like, why would they fight for that? It's like these are all like reasonable reasons why someone would say no. But like in the heat of the moment, in that moment of like high emotion, high stakes, like it just sounds like treason. And in the eyes of like the law, it's like treason.
Yeah. And also like I think it is in that chapter, or maybe like it's in a different chapter, but Ichiro, he's thinking like they didn't do this with the like German Italian people. Like they didn't get cattled into camps. They weren't questioned what their allegiance was to, like their motherland country or to the country that they were born and raised in. And it's like, yeah, because it's just so much easier to pick out Japanese people from white people, right? That's pretty much like the reason why they were able to do it so effectively. Yeah. And
there are like records, like pretty much admitting that in like in history, right?
But another thing that I was surprised to see in this book was it's not just a book that takes place in like a Japan town. Like there are like white people in it. There's also like black people in it. There's Chinese people who are, you know, running businesses, and you know they were able to live outside of camps because they were not Japanese and they were insistent on their Chinese identity, and how there's like this weird relationship with the Japanese and Chinese in this town. And it was just like a very interesting way how like white supremacy really fucking pits everyone together, and it is kind of like the oppression Olympics in a way. And I was like, oh, okay, even back then, like we still have, I mean, especially back then, but like now you would think that we're a little bit better, but the sentiments are still kind of the same. Like there's a lot of criticisms against like the Asian American community saying like, oh, your suffering is not as big as suffering that Black Americans have endured. And it's just like, okay, but measuring our suffering against each other is allowing the white supremacists to win. It is not a contest that we should be participating in. So it was very interesting to see that dynamic in these chapters.
Yeah. Okay. I think this is where we meet her. But what are your thoughts of like the one, I guess not the one female character in the story, but the one like kind of female peer character in the story, Emmy, who is the woman that Kenji takes Ichiro to hang out with after a night of drinking?
I'm not really happy with her character. I wish there were more female characters in this book, but obviously, you know, it's
written by a dude in the 50s. Like, I feel yeah.
Well, it's just like women, Japanese American women who, you know, were released from camp. They, you know, they're in a very unique position because they weren't drafted. They weren't forced to like do the survey. And it's like, oh, I wonder like how they viewed the No-No Boys. I wonder how, because I know like from the documentary that I mentioned earlier in this episode, Jim Akutsu's mother, she was shunned by her community from other Japanese American mothers who were just like, my son fought in the war and died or came back maimed. You have no place in our church because they were Christians, and she was unable to go to church. She was shunned completely, and Jimakutsu's mother actually died by suicide. And that is pretty much what happens to Ichiro's mother. She dies by suicide. And I'm just like, okay, like, I would like to see more of, like, the women in this time period, how, like, they felt about no-no boys, how they felt about draft resistors, and how they use their privilege, as small as it was, to kind of, like, see how they stood in the community. I would have loved to have seen that, but this is not that book, though.
I feel like Emmy is definitely a literary victim of the times, like the time that this book was written in, where, like, those questions, not that John Okada wasn't interested, but just not the questions he was asking in this book, right?
Yeah, I mean, she was just kind of a character to show, kind of like a victim of the people who chose to fight in the military. It's just like, yeah, well, like, her husband left for Japan, and he continues to sign up for tours and not come back to America. And it's just like,
yeah, I think her husband Ralph is offered as, like, a counterpoint to Ichiro's own brother Taro, because, you know, Taro was too young to be drafted in the camps, but because of the shame that he feels for his brother being a draft resistor, has decided to, like, quit school and enlist in, like, the day he turns 18, right? Yep. Or right after he turns 18. And Emmy's husband Ralph is, like, serving extra tours in Europe because his brother, his older brother, defected to Japan after the war started.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So Emmy is just kind of a victim of circumstances and choices of other characters. So obviously I'm like, I don't think she's that strong of a female character. But again, a lot of the characters in this book are more like metaphors than actual. So you just kind of have to, like, read the book with that mindset. I thought it was really fucked up that Taro, Ichiro's younger brother, like, there's a scene where he lures Ichiro into, like, an alleyway, and a bunch of
teens, pretty much, yeah,
teens, like, beat him up because he was a draft resistor. And I was just like, that's insane. Okay, like, the things that some people will do to prove that they're American enough.
Yeah.
And it's like the opposite with, like, Ichiro. He's just like, I'm going to prove how Japanese I am. And it's like, in the end, no one fucking cares. You just get hurt in the end.
Well, but Taro himself also did not participate in the beating, which, you know, I think it was Ichiro who made the observation that, like, he's just as much of a coward as he was. In that he couldn't say no to his mom. Taro couldn't say no to his friends, but couldn't, like, live with his decision neither.
Yeah.
Ichiro
goes to Portland with Kenji because Kenji has to go see a surgeon because his leg is flaring up again. And this is an opportunity for Ichiro to start over. He's like, I don't have to stay in Seattle. I can go to a new town and get a job, and no one has to know about, like, my past or anything. So he, you know, goes job hunting. And what was, like, really crazy to me was, you know, after getting kind of rejected from previous jobs because they're like, oh, you didn't serve? Like, we don't want cowards as employees. He finds an employer who, you know, works at, like, a drafting firm, and it's related to his major. He was studying engineering at the time. So this is an ideal job for him, after getting out of prison and not finishing his education. And the employer, he's, like, very understanding. I mean, obviously he's racked with guilt because he's a white man and he didn't really do much for his Japanese tenants who got, you know, arrested and put into concentration camps.
Yeah, this is a theme we see again and again, which is, like, there are also a lot of white people who felt real bad about what their country did, and are doing small things to, like, make up for it. Like, ultimately not enough, but, like, helping people when they present themselves is kind of the least they can do, right? And he's willing to offer Ichiro this like really well-paying job as a way to like kind of satisfy his own guilt, right? His own conscience. And I think his name is Mr. Carrick. He's, I think one of the themes that this book does a really good job illustrating and something that really resonated with me, especially today in 2026, is like this idea that like you can love your country, but also not be okay with what your country is doing, right? Like those are two things that can exist at the same time.
Extreme patriotism is not a thing to be proud of.
And it also represents the like what Ichiro needs to like kind of reconcile with himself, which is like, it sucks that this happened to him. It sucks that he had to make this choice. But at the same time, it's kind of great that he lives in a place where he could make that choice, but still be free to walk around, to be free to live, right? That's kind of something that can also only happen in America. The idea of the American dream, the idea of like American freedom, it's still something worth like striving towards, even when reality kind of sucks.
But like when he's offered this very like lucrative job, he turns it down. Like he's like, I don't deserve it. Like it should be given to like a quote unquote good Japanese, someone who served, someone who, you know, didn't say no, someone who has more honor. Like that level of kindness should not be given to me. And it's like, oh my God, Ichiro, like get your bag. I mean, come on, man.
I mean, at this point, he hasn't reached that epiphany yet, right? He's still thinking that he's undeserving because he still sees himself as a traitor, as a criminal, as someone who doesn't deserve the second chance or this chance to start over, right? Because at this point, America, the country, also has not admitted fault neither, right?
Yeah. The real traitor is the American system, but it like, you know, he knows it. But he still has so much guilt, and it's just like really hard to watch because he is being very self-destructive. And I'm like, there is a way out. There is hope. You literally got a job offer in a new town where you can build a new life for yourself, and he turns it down.
Yeah. And you know, that's something that also, like I said, can happen here in America, because there are people who believe in second chances, believe in starting over, believe in rectifying wrongs, right? And if the system won't do it, they will. Individuals with the community will do it. But, you know, Ichiro's not there yet. Ichiro's still, like, in his head. And he also needs to close the book on a lot of things back home in Seattle, where he realizes that he left a lot of things unfinished. I'm sure he ultimately regrets his decision because, man, that was pretty good money. But, you know, he does head back after Kenji. He meets Kenji again in the hospital. Kenji is not doing well, and so Kenji gives him his car. The chapter before this was the chapter where we follow Kenji as he goes home. I really like that chapter as well. Like when we meet Kenji's dad and his brother and sister, and kind of see like another like Issei narrative, like of Kenji's dad, who was like a single father who worked as a painter to put his kids through school and college, who put down roots essentially, and is now enjoying the fruits of his labors, even though it's bittersweet because his son won't, he'll end up outliving his son.
Also, it's just like, oh, when you come from like a loving, healthy family dynamic, like it's like ultimately you'll be okay, you know, like yeah. Where as opposed to like Ichiro and Taro, they come from this family that's like really dysfunctional. And it is interesting because Ichiro mentions like, I wish my dad was like my mom, like strong and uncompromising and like decisive, but he's so weak. He's so like, he just lets his wife dominate him, even though he doesn't agree with her decisions. And he's like, you know, my mom really should have been the man of the house. And but it's just like, it doesn't matter because it's still a fucked up like family dynamic, and it wouldn't have saved your relationship or like your familial relationships with each other.
I think that's just toxic. Yeah, I think that's just Ichiro's like toxic masculinity leaking out, because he is kind of a toxic man in a lot of ways. A lot of toxic dudes in the story.
I mean,
sure.
it's the patriarchy. It's the military. It's like, oh, you have to prove that you are like macho enough. Like what are you, a woman because you didn't serve in the military? And it's just like, that doesn't mean that you're weak. Because it's a different kind of strength, okay? And yeah, so like the contrast between Kenji's family life and how accepting and loving and supportive they are versus Ichiro's family, where everyone is like, what is happening?
Yeah, well, one of the main difference is that, you know, Kenji's dad has accepted that he isn't going back to Japan, that this is where his kids live, this is where his family is now. Which is something that Ichiro's family does not have, because his mom still has like extreme ties, like delusional ties to her country. And I think it's interesting because, you know, Ichiro's mom eventually commits suicide when she's broken out of that delusion, right? She is like, before Ichiro leaves for Portland, he like, his dad makes her read a letter from her sister, because at this point, you know, post-war Japan, things are really tough, right? There's a lot of shortages, food shortages. Like, it's not a good scene back home. And I think, and reading this letter from her sister, snaps her out of like her fugue state. I don't know if it snaps her out of it, but like, it becomes harder and harder to accept the delusion, right? And eventually she does commit suicide. And then after she's gone, we see Ichiro's dad start to come out of his shell, right? Like, he is essentially relieved of like this tie to Japan. And, you know, if you look at this purely as like metaphor and fully accepting that the fact that this, you know, this metaphorical tie, this metaphorical weight that's been around his ankle was his wife and mother to his children. He kind of like is able to move on after she is gone.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the horrible thing about abusive family relationships, right? It's like, sometimes your life doesn't begin until their life ends, because, you know, you feel like your life is not your own. And there's so much darkness weighing down on your daily choices because they don't feel like choices. And it's like, I mean, that is very metaphorical of toxic, abusive relationships. You're like, okay, finally, I can like live. But also, it's so sad. It's so tragic, because in my head, I'm like, I mean, she was delusional, but it was like a severe consequence of the trauma that she went through in the camp. Like, it's not her fault. And honestly, like, if there was more of like a counseling support network, I'm sure she, you know, she would have recovered. But, you know, this is the 1950s, and, you know, like, with the mentality of like, we need to get back to normal as fast as possible and forget about what happened to us in the camps and also in the war, it's like, well, that's a detriment to her mental health. So ultimately, it's very, very tragic. And but it's understandable, the relief that Ichiro's father feels. And, you know, it did feel a little bit gross reading about like the funeral and how like Ichiro's dad, like Ichiro was saying that like, oh, his dad kind of feels important now. That now that his like mom's not there, and he's like kind of soaking up on like the special attention, and I'm like, it's a little gross.
I mean, I think part of it is just like in the construction of the story, Ichiro's mom, kind of like Emmy, is kind of used as like a device more than a person, right?
Yeah.
But I guess this leads to I guess the next scene, the next chapter is Ichiro falling upon the lead on a job in Seattle, right? Where he can kind of just lay low and disappear into his work, essentially. So his friend Freddie hooks him up with a Christian rehabilitation center, right? Where one of their other fellow Nono boys, Gary, works. And his conversation with Gary is also like really important. Like, it's another like, you know, it's not, again, not a subtle book. It's kind of like John Okazaki kind of just telling you what the characters think and feel all the time. But it's like, Noguera explains that, like, he's actually not laying low. It's like, this is kind of just what he wants to do. Like, this is a good deal for him. Like, he studied art. Like, he's an art major before the war. And, like, he's a, like, his dream is to, like, complete a work of art, a painting. And so, like, this job allows him to kind of, you know, paint stuff during the day, but also work during the night. And it's like, it's, he's not there to hide out. He's there because this is what he wants to do, which is completely different than the reason why Ichiro wanted that job.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also, like, very apparent that the people who got jobs through this rehabilitation center, you know, they don't have any other choice. Like, they're, like, this is, like, their saving grace. They're, like, they're hanging by a thread. And, you know, like, even the people who are running the rehabilitation center, they're like, Ichiro, like, you have so much to live for. Like, you have all your limbs. Like, you have an education. Like, you're not on, like, your last leg to stand on. I mean, it's rough that you, you know, went to jail, but it's not, like, unrecoverable. And that's like the second half of Ichiro's journey, like, him finally having hope and, you know, realizing that he's not the traitor. It's the American system that is the traitor. And,
yeah,
you know, everybody is fucked up because of the war, and it's not anybody's individual fault.
Yeah. So that brings us to the last chapter, which is his last night out with Freddy, which, like, I forgot that Freddy was doomed, like, until I got to this chapter. I was like, oh, yeah, I know what's coming. But, you know, he, after his conversation with Gary, comes to an epiphany. He's kind of, like, ready to start a new leaf. But Freddy wants one last night. Freddy wants to go out and, like, party. And I think he, at this point, he's worried about Freddy. He's worried about what Freddy would do if he's not with him, right? Like, he's like your friend that, like, if you don't watch him, he's going to do something stupid or get himself killed, right? And so he agrees to go out for one last bender, for one night. He agrees to go out with Freddy to have some fun. And that fun turns into a brawl in the alleyway and ends up with Freddy essentially getting killed. It's like a very, I guess, I don't know what the right word to say, but like a classic ending for this type of book, which ends in like someone dying because of their excess, right?
Yeah, it did remind me of Great Gatsby in a way, with like a tragic main character death. And yeah. I think, yeah.
Yeah.
There was, like, also a car crash in that book as well. So,
yeah. And like, Freddy was someone who also, like Ichiro, had stuff to live for, right? He struck up a relationship with his neighbor who you know, he, like, this book, again, like, probably should have put triggers up front, but lots of very, like, derogatory language that's very, like, contemporary of the time, but, like, reading it in, like, 2026. A little uncomfortable sometimes, right? Like, when people getting called all sorts of, there's names we don't use anymore. And, but, like, he has a good thing going for him. He has a job, he has a neighbor, he has, you know, a girl that he sees and whose dad really likes him enough to give him a car to drive around in, right? But he's still stuck in where he's stuck where Ichiro was in chapter one, which is like, I'm not really living. I don't really deserve all these things. I don't really, like, none of these things are real to me.
Yeah. And, the reason why Freddy dies is because there's this veteran who, like, his name is Bull, I think.
He's the guy that we meet along with Kenji in that, I think, chapter 3 or 4, the one that came in with the white girl, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I have thoughts about, like, how these guys are saying, oh, don't go for a Japanese girl, go for a white girl. That means that you've succeeded. And I'm like, okay. We're doing this, okay?
But the reason
why Freddy dies is because Bull, he, you know, gets all, like, in his face, like, all macho, being like, you're a no-no boy, you didn't serve, like, you're a traitor to our country. And then Freddy gets in his car, and then because of some, I don't actually know what happened when I was reading it, and I kept, like, going back to read like how he got in the car and how it accelerated to a point where he just like crashed into a building. Like, was that on purpose or was
that? I think he was trying to get away. I think Bull was on him, and so that's why he was leaning. He was like hanging outside the car, but he wasn't seated. Like, he wasn't buckled in, essentially. And so when he sped away into the street, he got hit by another car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it, and in the end, like, Bull begins to cry. And, you know, and Ichiro is, like, comforting him because Bull is going to go to prison now for manslaughter at the very least. And it's just, and it's very interesting that despite all of this death and tragedy, Ichiro leaves the scene with like the sense of hope for the future. And I was like, interesting way to end the book, Okada. Okay.
I think, okay, so the way that I read it this time was, because the first time I read it back in like 2004, I was also a little like confused, right? But I think he was already kind of there at the beginning of this chapter. And I think what Freddie and Bull represent is people still stuck in this, like, essentially fugue of despair, right? They're both still stuck in the war. They're both still stuck in prison and battlefield. They're both still stuck in camp, right? And Ichiro, for the first time, is like, has, like, seen the light at the end of the tunnel, seeing that there are people willing to extend a hand. There are people who still act on like America, the ideal, not America, the system of laws, right? And so like this final confrontation is just an example of like this, the kind of situation he would have ended up in if he had not come to this epiphany. And so I think that's why he has hope. But it is a little abrupt because it's like literally a paragraph after like his friend just died, right?
Yeah. It's just like, oh, his friend, which is, you know, an alternate version of him. It's just like, oh, that despairing part of me that was like self-destructive, now he is dead. So a lot of metaphors that are embodied as people dying, you know, like Ichiro's friend Kenji dies, Ichiro's mom dies, Freddy dies, and it's like at this point they are casualties of war, even though the war is over. So lots of death. So that is the end of the book.
Actually, I wanted to get you, because you touched on this again. You touched on this a little bit when you talked about Bull and, you know, the white woman he brought to the club. But like, there's a scene, I think it was the chapter before they go to Portland, where Kenji is kind of driving around on his way to Ichiro's place, kind of thinking about like, he had his own like, I have a dream moment, right? And kind of like laying out his dream of like Japanese people not having to just like get together with Japanese people, right? And like there was a thing that his dad tells Ichiro after he dies, which is like he requested not to be buried in the Japanese community lot. Like he doesn't want to be buried with other Japanese, right? What did you think about that?
I think like if I remember correctly, I don't think it was because like he said like, oh, I don't want to be buried with the Japanese community. I think it was because there was this cemetery that was reserved specifically for white families, white veterans. And as kind of like a show of atonement, like the cemetery's like, oh, we'll have like a section for Japanese American vets who have like died in service. And he's just like, I don't want to be buried there. I do not want to be like, them being like, oh, you should be grateful that we saved a spot for you. Like, I felt like that was his whole thing of like, I don't want to be buried under their terms. I want to be buried under mine because I've already had to fight in a war under their terms. So this was a way for him to kind of be free from all of that politics in a way. I mean, that's at least how I saw it.
Yeah. And he's definitely like, he's the only veteran character who like does not view his service through like a sense of like pride, right? Like, or not the sense of pride, but he's probably served, he's probably fought, but like, he doesn't have any delusion that like it was the right thing to do. Like he doesn't think it makes him moral superior, which is what makes his character like important to Ichi's development.
Yeah, it's like extreme patriotism is a disease, and you know we see it today with like the veneration of like the police force and people who served in our many wars. Like that's crazy to me that like when you said, oh, like I got back from the war, it's like, which war? Like we've had so many as America. So yeah, to have a character who's just like who's just like, I'm not buying into this patriotism thing. I'm not buying into proving that I'm a citizen when I'm already a citizen, and I don't have to be a model minority. I don't have to be a quote unquote good Japanese to feel worthy.
I feel like he's one of those veterans who like would say like something like, I fought in the war for your right to say no. And there's a lot of people in this book that like believe that way, right? That like it's your American right to like say no to injustice. That should be the American way, even if the laws don't say so. And even though if your community doesn't say so. I am curious, as someone who has read this book for the first time in 2026, what did you think?
I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it because, like I said, I'm like, the characters are metaphors. The women characters, there could have been just like so much more depth with it. It is a short novel. It is written in an omniscient narrator's point of view. A lot of head hopping because, you know, even though Ichiro is our protagonist, we're, you know, lingering around like Kenji's POV and also like Ichiro's dad's POV. So it is kind of like a stream of consciousness, which is not my favorite type of writing. And I can respect the fact that it is such like a pillar in Asian American literature, especially in Japanese American literature, because prior to the war, I understand that the Japanese American community, they were very well read. They, you know, had a lot of their own like community newspapers and magazines, and after the war they kind of had to rebuild that from scratch. So like I really respect the place that Nono Boy has in Asian American literature history, but at the same time I'm like, I don't know, the only comparison I can give is like, you know, when Psycho, the movie, the Hitchcock movie came out, like, I'm sure it, like, people flipped the fuck out because the main character for, like, the first third of the movie dies in the middle. And you're like, wow, what's going to happen now? Like, that's never happened before. But now, like, as, like, someone who lives in present day, we're just like, we've seen works do that. We've seen works inspired by the OG do it even better. So that's kind of how I feel. I'm just like, it must have been so refreshing and such a shock to the system in the 70s where, you know, you are trying to fight for ethnic studies. You are grappling with the draft from the Vietnam War and civil rights. But now I'm just like, I'm happy that I can say I've read better books. I've read better books that have gone deeper into nuances.
Yeah. So
that's my feeling on it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, context is really important for this book too, because the story of the book, the publishing story, is also like almost as fascinating as the book itself. And like ironically ongoing, right? Because we covered the Nono Boy story when Penguin Random House tried to publish it on their own terms because it went into public domain, sidestepping the Okada estate and that whole shebang. I don't know which episode it was, but like reading again and like understanding more about the context of when it was published, how it was published, like it's definitely a very like raw book, right? I imagine that the publisher that Okada went through didn't really spend a lot of time and effort reading it, editing it, because again, there's nothing to compare it to, right? And it's also a Japanese publisher, so they might not be looking for the same things. And so, you know, there's probably a more refined version after a few like revisions in this book, but that's not the story of how this book was published. But
yeah, I wonder what his second novel was gonna be. I mean, he said in a letter to his publisher that he is working on like a second manuscript that's about the Issei experience. So yeah, the generation before Nisei, the Japanese immigrants. And you know, he never finished it. And then whatever he's written is gone now. And we have that mystery. And in my head, I'm like, this is No No Boy is a decent debut novel. Like, it seems like it was something that he really needed to get off of his chest in order to get to, I guess, his masterpiece. Like, that's how I feel about it. I don't think No No Boy is a masterpiece. I think it is an important piece of literature, and it's a part of history.
Yeah,
that's wrapped in fiction.
Yeah, I mean, his second novel would have been the novel he wrote about his parents' generation. We've seen novels written by like our contemporaries about the first generation of like Korean immigrants, of like Chinese immigrants. One would argue Pachinko is a certain similar type of book about like the parents and grandparents' generation, right? And so like, would this have been Japanese American Pachinko? Maybe, maybe not. But I do think it sucks that we did miss out on his second novel, because he would have had firsthand experience with Issei, right? Any book about the Issei generation written today, the research is done through secondary sources. Like, the primary sources are all, they're all gone, right? And so that is a tragedy that we never got that book.
I also find it very interesting that John Okada, like, his trade was being a librarian. He was a librarian for like a good amount of his career before he switched to becoming like a technical writer. He was kind of like this madman marketing writer later in his life. But, you know, he went to school for archiving, for becoming a master's of like librarian studies. And I'm like, so interesting that he wrote a book to preserve the feelings of the time of like coming out of post-war as a Japanese American. And he knew how important that was, because he was just like, I don't want America to forget this stain in history. And it's just like, that's a very librarian historian way to look at things and to write your book in that way.
Yeah. And just the fact that like reading it today in 2026, like the themes all still apply. Depressingly, they all apply. Like all the things that Ichiro went through, you know, like the feeling of like, can I be loyal to both the country of my birth and the country of my parents, the country of my heritage and the country of my, you know, livelihood? Like, is that something that is possible? Is that something that I'm allowed to do? It is still the heart and soul of a lot of Asian American literature today.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm glad that we have our own classics, you know? We have our own The Great Gatsby, we have our own like Cabin in the Woods, like we have our own literary canon thanks to authors like John Okada and the archivists who have you know, compiled these early Asian American writers and made it accessible to generations today, to new writers of this generation today. If you compare the landscape of publishing like back then to now, it's really fascinating to see how we're allowed to tell different stories now. It's not just the same struggle immigrant story.
Still wild to think that this book came out the same year as Flower Drum Song, that there were two Asian American novels published in 1957. You know, this one obviously more critical of the American dream than Flower Drum Song was. And that's probably why it didn't gain traction, right?
Yeah. But No No Boy did get made into a play. So
yeah, there was also controversy around that. They changed the ending to make it more happy.
Yeah, and they did.
Frank Chin got pissed. I think that one was written and directed by Ken Narasaki, who's also a community member in the LA theater community. And you know, Drive Resisting is also a big plot point in the musical Allegiance, which was on Broadway for a few years as well. Was it on Broadway? I think it was off Broadway, right? I don't really remember.
Yeah, I don't really remember either.
Yeah.
But Illusions by George Takei, you know. You guys can look it up.
Yeah.
Speaking of looking it up, I'll also share the link to the documentary that I watch in search of No-No Boy in our Discord. There's also a video of an interview with like Frank Abe and another collaborator on No-No Boy that was like done like 7 years ago at the Japanese American National Museum. They have like whole like 1 hour and 20 minute video on just this topic. So I'll also share that in our Discord. Yeah. It's just fascinating. This book is like so short and there's just so much history wrapped around it, and people can write dissertations and other books about it.
I mean, it predates literally every other classic on the list by like a good 20 plus years, right? Yeah. So it's like, it is important, and I'm glad that we read it for this book club, and I think we had a really great discussion about it. And, you know, if you all have your own thoughts about what we talked about or about the book itself, please let us know on our Discord. Love to hear, you know, your guys' thoughts on this Asian American classic as well. But yeah, I guess with that, that'll do it for our discussion of No-No Boy by John Okada. Rira, can you let us know what book you picked for us to read for the month of June 2026?
Yeah, so June was my pick, and I chose The Chosen and the Beautiful by Ni Vo, and it is a magical reimagining of The Great Gatsby, and it follows a queer Vietnamese adoptee who is navigating the glamorous excesses of the 1920s. That's probably why I kept mentioning The Great Gatsby throughout like our talk, because it was already like...
Yeah.
Planted in my head, but you know,
let's stay in the Jazz Age, right? Let's live in the late 40s to 50s. You know, like this is the theme of this summer, is this Jazz Age. I think I love that there's a through line between No-No Boy and our next book as well.
Yeah, but we've read Ni Vo's previous work. We've read the novella The Empress of Salt and Fortune, which, you know, was a pretty like... I thought we had a pretty good discussion, so I encourage people to go check that out. I think Ni Vo is a very talented writer when it comes to like magic, so I'm really looking forward to seeing like how magical realism is gonna work in tandem with like the 20s aesthetics. So yeah. Excited.
Yeah, and as always, you can pick up our monthly book club picks on our online bookstores by going to booksandboba.com and clicking the bookshop link. All purchases made there support not only us here at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstores as well. So as always, thanks to everyone who has supported us by purchasing a book through our bookstore. But yeah, that'll do it for this episode and our discussion of No-No Boy by John Okada. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu, and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @BooksandBoba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone. Especially for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts. part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Hey, I'm Phil Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallusbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.
The Potluck Podcast Collective.